House Committee on Health and Human Services to order. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2160. And we have the amendments. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 2160, we received testimony on the 5th of February. What you hopefully have in front of you is a hand in gross House Bill 2160 with the dash one amendments per the Insurance Pool Governing Board's request, as well as a fiscal statement on that amendment. There is a fiscal impact. This bill does have a prior reference to Ways and Means, of which we won't be able to rescind at this point. But this is the bill that allows the IPGB to provide a subsidy to eligible individuals for the dental plan when the employer requires the employee to enroll in both the medical and the dental plan.
Okay, and just so the committee knows, the standard $50,000 window that we used to have for freshmen, it used to be anything under 50 did not necessarily have to go to Ways and Means. This time, everything goes to Ways and Means, even if it's a dollar. So, and in our current environment, I think that's appropriate. So, so any fiscal impact at all goes to Ways and Means, regardless of the size. Hopefully just for this session, but time will tell on that. So I would entertain a motion on the dash one amendments.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2160. Any discussion? Objections?
Tell me a little bit about the, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The dash one amendments. Can you explain that to a freshman?
Sure.
Dash one.
Go ahead, Sandy.
What the dash one amendments are doing is currently FEOP, the program, excludes dental subsidy or co-pays for the members.
I'm not so much concerned on substantive changes. Dash one just means this would be 2160-1.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm saying if each set of amendments gets a dash number, and if we're lucky, the numbers stay in single digits. If we're unlucky, they don't. So anybody who has an amendment suggestion to a bill, it will get a dash number, and then it's up to the committee to decide which ones they like and like that. We have seen dashes get up into the 90s before, but this bill, I don't think that's going to be a requirement. So.
Okay, great.
And then the dash, any amendments, if I may add, Mr. Chair, any amendments that are adopted into that original version will then make it an A when it comes to the floor. So when you see this scheduled for third reading, it will be 2160A.
All right.
And then if the Senate does anything to it and adds more to it, then that A goes into a B and so on and so forth, depending on how many changes are made.
Right. Thank you.
Does that help?
I probably should have been listening more carefully. I think in Section 3 of the amendment, basically, if then a health plan does not provide coverage for the immunizations, then FEOP will provide that coverage to the provider. Is that basically what that's saying?
Yes, but we can get confirmation from the agency. Mr. Urbani is here.
Good morning, and if you would explain Section 3 in human terms rather than legal terms, it would be helpful.
Representative Mona Sanderson, you're exactly right. There are some plans, particularly in the group market, that may cover all of the things that we require except immunization. In an effort to allow those plans to be subsidized, we would then pay directly for immunization services. Our current statutes don't allow us to do that. And this is a requirement of the federal waiver that we cover these immunizations.
Okay, Paula?
Yes.
Then how will the payments be made? What kind of tracking system would, like, say, a public health department have to do to be reimbursed?
Well, Representative, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Monis Anderson, because we're using Medicaid funds, we're a HIPAA-covered agency, so we will either contract these payments or make them in compliance with HIPAA, so there would be no additional requirements for a provider to bill us. We would respond to their standard billing practices.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion on the Dash 1 amendments? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 1s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2160, as amended, be referred to the Revenue Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2160, as amended, to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Cruz votes aye. House Bill 2160, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on 2160. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2021. Cedric, you want to come up and talk about this little thing? Good to see you, my friend.
Indeed.
Thank you for the invitation, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name for the record is Cedric Hayden. I reside at 46300 Big Fall Creek Road in the state metropolis of Fall Creek, Oregon. Mr. Chairman, what can I tell you about this little bill?
Everything.
All right. House Bill 2021 is a fairly simple bill, a step above a housekeeping bill. It came out of the, it's a committee bill that came out of the Interim Revenue Committee this session, last session. It basically restores the capital requirements that were in existence for dental and vision insurance companies on December 31, 2001 and January 1, 2002. I'll draw your attention to Section 1, Sub 3. I think that's probably the pertinent sections. Where we restore the funding that was in existence on December 31, 2001. Prior to December 31, 2001, I believe, as I researched it a little bit, I believe the capital requirements for a dental insurance company were about $50,000. At some point in time, they were raised to $250,000, and during the 2001 session, they were raised to $1 million. This is a difficult hurdle for a small entrepreneur company that would like to start up in Oregon to reach $1 million, plus an additional $250,000 in other assets. And it didn't seem to me to be necessary because the costs of dental insurance are tightly controlled, as at least one member of this committee can tell you, because of the copays and the deductibles and the approximately $1,500 per year annual limit in potential services to be provided by the insurance company to the insured. It's very hard to use up $250,000 in reserves, and I don't see how a small company could ever use up $1 million in reserves. So what this bill does is proposes that that we return to the amount of capital reserves of $250,000 that were in existence prior to January 1, 2002. Now, the reason that this should be done is that in order to maintain such a high requirement of $1 million, it will drive small startup dental insurance companies out of Oregon. They can go to Vermont, they can go to Hawaii, they can go to the Caymans and set up insurance companies, which are called captive reinsurance companies, and operate from there. And they can operate in Oregon, but their corporate headquarters would be out of state. And we think it would be good to have these companies serving Oregon citizens with a dedication to Oregon citizens to be incorporated in Oregon. This is particularly true in view of the fact that there is some pressure because of the economic crisis to decrease the amount of dental care or eliminate the amount of dental care that will be provided by the state through the Oregon Health Plan. And so some of these small dental insurance companies who can operate at a premium of between $6 and $50 per individual, depending on the services rendered, can to some degree fill that gap. So, Mr. Chairman, I submit this committee bill to your
Cedric,
for your consideration.
What was the rationale for the raise last session? Do you remember?
I believe that it got caught up with the medical insurance, the hospital insurance. The hospital insurance up to that point in time was, I think, $1 million, and it was raised to $2.5 million. And so I think I didn't do the detective work. I didn't go back and research why that happened. But probably it just got caught up. Dental and vision and I believe emergency medical transportation got caught up in that. And at some point in time, I noted that emergency medical transportation insurance companies for that, like what are these companies that will sell you, you know, $50 a year for all the ambulance service you need. They were dropped out, leaving only dental and vision. And at this point in time, I think my suggestion would be that we address the discrepancy with dental and vision. I believe it's probably fair to have a $2.5 million capital reserve for hospital and medical because one sick baby can eat up that much money. But that doesn't apply when you're doing a filling or an extraction or something. You just can't eat up that kind of reserves.
Okay. Any questions? Yes. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is new to me, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad to see you. I'm not sure I really understand. You have someone who wants to just provide dental and vision services, I mean, like an insurance company. And they can't do it unless they have, and that this is where I'm confused, the money. Just their capital outlay? I mean, whose capital outlay?
Representative Mona Sanderson, Mr. Chairman.
Get it.
All right. The insurance commissioner in the state of Oregon, with due diligence, requires all insurance companies to have adequate reserves to provide the services they say they will provide to their insured, to their clients.
And that could follow up?
Yeah.
And that's what this $250,000 would be? I've got it.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hayden, have there been any small businesses that have started up and failed that you know of?
It's pretty hard with good management not to have this, not to be able to put this together, because the dental insurance companies have a good deal of control over the services provided, when they're provided, in the amount they're provided, and with the copayment of say 50% on a crown, and the deductibles of $25 to $50 per year that the insured must pay, and the premiums that they pay, which could be somewhere between, like as I said, between $6 and $50, depending on the level of services, it's pretty difficult. I do remember maybe 20 years ago that a dental insurance company associated with Sacred Heart Medical Center stopped doing business. I don't think that they failed. I think they just stopped providing the service.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, sir.
Representative Westland.
You were looking hale and hearty, sir, and it is excellent to see you.
I brought this for you, Representative. I come bearing tales of great mountains, fire and ice.
Yeah. Where is that?
South America.
Oh, good for you, sir.
Cedric is a mountain climber. Par extraordinaire.
Wow.
And we know that it must be February because the beard's coming back.
Exactly.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's not up there.
Yes, Representative Monis.
We don't have anyone from the insurance companies that... I mean, it just seems like I need more background on why the amount of money that should be held in reserves. And I get nervous because I know what's happened with CERS, and look at the liability they have. They certainly don't have enough in reserves right now. And so and this is very small comparatively.
Well, Representative, I think Dr. Hayden pretty much characterized this as something that got caught up in something else, and I think it's relatively safe to say that if anybody had real angst about this, that they would be here today, and they're not. So, I mean, this has been posted, so.
Then follow up. What if we have a lot of bankruptcies? I mean, I know that with dental, those providing dental insurance isn't quite as much maybe as those that provide vision. I don't know.
Well, Representative, what we're doing is taking this back to where it was 2 years ago, and we didn't have a problem at that point in time. So... I'm assuming we're going back to a status quo that worked.
Exactly so. Right, Mr. Chairman. And might I say that I do not believe that there is any fiscal impact to the state whatsoever.
And there is not.
And no revenue.
And no revenue impact either.
In its current form.
Thank you.
So. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2021, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2021.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2021 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2021 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Weston. Aye. Aye. House Bill 2021, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Anderson, as a retired dentist, would you like to carry this bill?
Love to.
Representative Anderson will carry, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2021.
Are we ready there?
I'm sure. So do you want to go into, we can just go into that. Public hearing on House Bill 2240. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2240 is brought forward at the request of the Board of Dentistry. It's establishing a Board of Dentistry account in the State Treasury. It's modifying conditions under the Oregon Board of Dentistry that they may refuse to issue or renew a license. It modifies the procedures relating to applicants failing the licensing examinations, and it limits durations of proceedings or investigation of the applicants, licensees, and former licensees. It is repealing a couple of statutes, the ORS 679040, which is the designation as a dentist as prima facie evidence, and 679105, a specialty licensing.
Okay.
In its current form, there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay. Dr. Paul Leinstrub, did I do that right? And I'm assuming you're Lori?
I'm Lori Lindley.
Okay,
Mr.
Cool.
Chair and committee from the Department of Justice. And I represent the Oregon Board of Dentistry.
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Kleinstub, K-L-E-I-N-S-T-U-B. I'm the dental director and chief investigator for the Board of Dentistry. In reference to House Bill 2240, the bill makes several housekeeping and minor program changes to the Dental Practice Act. Proposed changes repeal portions of the Dental Practice Act that are out of date and unnecessary, make minor changes that will allow the board to better protect the public, and clarifies the status of the board within the executive branch to allow discretion in obtaining fiscal and personnel services. The Oregon Dental Association and the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association support this bill. There's no known major opposition to the bill. I'd like to go over some of the minor program changes. One amendment clarifies the definition of dental assistant to allow supervision by a dental hygienist. This is needed to allow dental assistants to assist limited access dental hygienists who work in a setting such as a nursing home outside of a dental practice, and there is no dentist to supervise either the dentist or the dental hygienist. This definition is also changed to allow dental assistants to help dental hygienists who are working in a dental office without the dentist present. As the rule stands now, a dental assistant works under the general supervision of a dentist, which means that in reference to the present rule allows dental assistants to work under the indirect supervision of a dentist. That means that a dentist can authorize the dental assistant to do procedures, but requires that the dentist be in the office when those procedures are done. Dental hygienists can work under the general supervision of a dentist, meaning that a dental hygienist can work in a dental office without the dentist being present. In some cases, there are patients that are difficult to handle, and the dental hygienist may need a dental assistant to assist and just help manage the patient. Under the present definition, a dental assistant can't help a dental hygienist when the dentist isn't in the office.
A follow-up?
Question, Representative
Monsanto. Well, we have to answer the first question.
Sorry. Is this a billing issue also? I want clarification. So a dental hygienist can bill for services without a dentist there. And do insurance companies cover dental assistants too? That's just a general question. Does insurances cover the services that a dental assistant provides?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, in general, dental assistant fees their salary, because they're generally on an hourly rate, aren't included or billed separately. It's sort of part of the procedure.
Assistants don't give direct service. They assist in service.
Well, in certain circumstances, a dental assistant can provide direct services. For example, taking dental radiographs.
Okay.
Another change modifies the conditions the board may consider in refusing to issue or renew a license to include discipline by another healthcare licensing agency. Current statute limits issues to criminal convictions or license suspension or revocation. For example, if a licensee or an applicant has been disciplined in another state and has been disciplined in something other than revocation or suspension, the board cannot use that disciplinary action to possibly not allow that person to practice in the state. Also, as it presently stands, if a licensee of the board also has a license in another profession, such as a physician or so on, if they're disciplined in another state as a physician and they hold two licenses, the board doesn't have the jurisdiction to discipline them or refuse licensure in Oregon. Another change adds language to clarify the time period. The board has jurisdiction over a license that is expired, retired, revoked, suspended, or retired. For example, if a licensee retires today and tomorrow the board gets a complaint about that licensee's practice, something that could have had some fairly significant complications, the board can't discipline them at this point.
Question?
Hey, Representative Mona Sanderson.
What is the time limit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, you mean how long or how far out can we or should we be able to do that? It'll be 4 years because a licensee who retires a license can get a license back in 4 years.
And what is it now?
Well, it's still 4 years, but now we need the authority to discipline someone who's in that retired status.
Thank you.
Another change amends language to provide discretion on the part of the board in enforcement of a disciplinary action that is under just judicial review. And I'd like to have Assistant Attorney General Lindley explain that.
Sure. Our current statutes have certain...
Please identify yourself.
My name is Lori Lindley. I'm with the Department of Justice. Mr. Chair and representatives, the current statute allows us when a discipline case is on appeal, in other words, the licensee or mostly the licensee is appealed and it's in the judicial review state, that we can only stay, in other words, prevent that dentist from practicing under certain circumstances. And they're very strict. And the Section 183 of the Oregon Revised Statutes under the contested case process allows a broader discretion to current other health-related boards, and that is basically this change in House Bill 2240 is bringing that in line with Section 183. The statute in under 679-160 is more restrictive, and we're trying to get rid of that restriction, have more discretion on behalf of the board to stay, in other words, get a licensee not be able to practice during an appellate process if, in fact, it's a risk to the public. So it's giving them more discretion in consistency with the current statutes under 183.
Let me ask you, there's been a couple, and while you're here, there's been a couple amendments suggested, and I would like your take on them. One would be page 1, line 9, would be to delete after the word dentist to delete or dental hygienist, and the other one would be on line 16 after who to insert under the supervision of a dentist. Now I think the intent there is to clarify command and control outside, you know, in normal situations. I don't want to speak for that, but with that language, what do you think?
Well, Mr. Chair, I partially addressed the supervision issue in reference to the circumstance where a dental hygienist working in a dental office without the dentist present doesn't have the opportunity under that change to have a dental assistant helping. And there may be a pediatric patient or an elderly patient or anybody where the hygienist needs the services of a dental assistant. And if that amendment was added, that wouldn't be a possibility.
Okay. Jane, come on up.
Thank you.
what I should have done in the first place, rather than try to explain the amendment, somebody else's amendment, I'll let them explain them themselves. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association. I'm not sure I'm addressing the question of the amendments or...
Well, that's, you know, your concern with the bill was the parts you want to amend, and I'm kind of hearing that this, the amendments may kind of change intent, so...
Our view of the need for the amendments, there are two issues that we don't support in the bill. One of them is the language that a dental hygienist may supervise a dental assistant. That means that all dental hygienists may supervise all dental assistants. First of all, it's, in our opinion, not needed. The board's statute already allows them to make and enforce rules necessary for the procedure of the board, conduct of exams, regulating the practice of dentistry, regulating the services of dental hygienists and dental auxiliary personnel, which would include the assistants, not inconsistent with the provisions of this chapter. It wouldn't be needed. The board could, by rule, determine dental assistants may work with dental hygienists when the dentist is not in the office. If they so choose to do that, that would be the simple way of doing this.
At this point in time, that can't happen, right?
No, I don't agree with that. By rule, the board could let them do that.
But has the board done that?
I'm not sure that isn't already taking place, that dental assistants aren't working in dental offices when dentists are not in the office at the moment. Because sometimes the board has made rules to allow the dental hygienist to see new patients and perform some services, with a follow-up exam by the dentist within a certain amount of time. So what's going on in the dental offices, I can't say for sure without, finding out from our members. The thing we want it to clarify is that not all dental hygienists have the same training as all dental assistants. Most of it, yes, is the same, but not all of it. For instance, there is a dental assistant who is specially trained to work with the oral maxillofacial surgeons, and they're doing monitoring of people who are coming out of anesthesia of different kinds, and not all dental hygienists would be able to supervise that function. So, it causes a liability issue in the minds of the dentists who I represent, who are the employers of both the hygienists and the assistants. And if there is a need for a statutory change, then we'd be happy to try to work that out to make sure everyone who's supervising has the appropriate training to supervise the person they're trying to assist. Because, underneath it all are patient safety issues. Because there are patient safety issues, it raises red flags to employer dentists who are carrying liability issues for their employees and patients who they're treating. So we want to make sure we do it right and not, we just don't agree that all dental hygienists should supervise all dental assistants. So that's issue one. Issue two is...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on to issue two, I guess, Jane, just a quick question. Do we have situations where we have, dental hygienists operating in schools without, school clinics without a dentist themselves just doing screenings or, doing whatever it is dental hygienists do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in answer to your question, dental hygienists who have a permit issued by the board, requires more education, may conduct exams in schools.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. And so, Jane, what if they have, dental assistants with them assisting in the service at school? Would they still be able to supervise that dental assistant?
I think the answer to the question is probably a no. And the amendment that we were suggesting to the bill should cover the should cover that situation, because the amendment we're saying is a dental hygienist with the permit. So that's this hygienist may work without the supervision of a dentist. That's what the law says now, and they can work in schools. So we're offering an amendment that would say they can, that hygienist holding that permit may employ a dental hygienist or a dental assistant and supervise the dental assistant, of course. So that would clear that issue up if it is occurring. I don't know that it is actually occurring, because I'm not sure, although there are people with the permit, how much actual work is being done out there in schools or other places is a unknown.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Follow up on the same thing that the representative from Salem was saying. It is Salem, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
My niece is a dental hygienist, and my other niece is a dental assistant. And she does a lot of volunteering at Job Corps on the coast. She goes there and she provides services. Would the dental assistant be able to assist her in the cleanings or whatever? I don't even know what the job descriptions are of a dental assistant now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the answer to your question, if I've got it correct, I mean, you're talking about working at Job Corps, is your niece is either performing the screening under the supervision of a dentist, who that is very typical, or maybe is a permit holder and then is allowed to work in schools without the supervision of a dentist. Now, whether the assistant can be involved in that, I think that refers back to Representative Dalto's question. If the dentist is supervising, certainly, that's no problem. I'm not terribly clear on the answer about whether the limited access permit dental hygienist, if she or he is conducting an exam or doing work in a school, whether that allows them to have a dental assistant. But once again, the amendment we're trying to offer would clear that matter up entirely.
Just follow up on that.
Yes.
And I should have talked to my niece before I came into committee this morning.
We look
but
her now.
She said,
"You'll pay for it."
Yeah, that one right over there.
I know that she was talking about an issue, and maybe this is the difference between having a permit or not. That there had been a problem with providing services because there wasn't a dentist on the coast. I mean, that's why they went to the Job Corps. There weren't enough dentists, so the dentist wouldn't be on site, and they provide services. So, and I thought we passed a bill two years ago, on this. And this would allow them, the dental hygienist, to provide the services to people like the Job Corps people without. So this time, I just want to know, with the way the law is written now, it doesn't seem like then the dental assistant can assist the dental hygienist at Job Corps where there's not a dentist on site. Do you understand what I'm...
I do understand that. Let's break it into two situations, one where the hygienist has the permit.
Okay.
An amendment may be necessary to make certain that they may employ and have an assistant work with them. Where the hygienist does not have a permit, generally the dentist is involved in this exam. I can't see how otherwise it might work. It's a screening. So the dentist has responsibility for, if he is sending the hygienist out there or working with a hygienist, may send out an assistant. And if there's an obstacle to that, I believe the statute gives the Board of Dentistry the discretion to write a rule that says, yes, you may do that. Not only can you supervise the hygienist, who's your employee, under general supervision, which means, you know, the dentist is going to conduct a screening and I'm going to take their staff out there, they could take the hygienist under their supervision as well as the assistant under their supervision to the site and conduct screenings.
Paul, would you like to comment on this line of questioning?
Mr. Chair, I sure would. Dental hygienists, by statute, can only do dental hygiene things. So a dental assistant can only assist a dental hygienist doing the dental hygiene services. It's not clear that the dental hygiene services, per se, would be any different provided in a dental office versus in this limited access setting. Jane spoke of the liability issue. In the office setting, the dental assistant is still under the supervision of a dentist, except in the circumstance where the dental assistant would be in the office without the dentist. And what our change is going to allow is the assistant to work with the hygienist, I explained before. In the circumstance of the screening, because under the present rule, dental assistants can only work when a dentist is in the office. If a dental hygienist goes out to do the screening procedures and that dental hygienist doesn't have a limited access permit, the dental assistant can't go with her.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been in this situation. When I was practicing, especially of dentistry, we always made sure that the assistant would be responsible to the hygienist only when I wasn't in the office. There are situations where the assistant is more expert than the dental hygienist. For instance, if a dental assistant is working with an endodontist, she gets to know a lot more about root canal therapy than the hygienist who is working in her own specific area. If she's working with an oral surgeon, as Ms. Myers pointed out, oftentimes the assistant is much more capable in one small niche than the hygienist. So I think we're talking about the kind of care that the hygienist is doing oversight in. And I think we need to be careful. I think the dentist is the one that's got to take the final liability. The dentist is one that should be doing all of the supervision unless he's not there. And if he's not there, the hygienist should not be overseeing things that she's not familiar with. So I think we need some more time here to really work this out between the your interests and Ms. Myers' interests and get the amendments clear as to what the hygienist is really supervising, whether she's supervising in dental hygiene and things that the assistant can take as instruction from her, or whether she's supervising in areas where she isn't as capable as the dental hygienist, which are very small areas. Generally, I agree with the principle of the dentist giving authority to the hygienist, giving authority to the assistant in that chain of command.
That's okay.
But it is essentially the dentist who takes the final liability, and therefore he should have the final say in instruction down the chain.
You answered my question.
Along that line, can I just follow up? When I sold my practice, I sold it to another periodontist who does give his... He's not in the office a lot of the time. He's in another city in a different practice. And so he authorized the hygienist to do a lot they take charge over the assistants, but it's only in the areas of dental hygiene, not in areas where the dentist is more expert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, according to our present rules, if the dentist isn't in the office, the dental assistant can't do anything. Our present rules say that a dental assistant works under the indirect supervision of a dentist. So the scenario you just proposed isn't possible under our rules today, in that a dentist authorizes the assistant to help the hygienist when the dentist isn't in the office.
In terms of care, But there are plenty of things that the dental assistant does, sharpening instruments, repairing things that aren't necessarily dental care. And that, as I read it, can be done.
Mr. Chair.
Good.
I just wanted to add to Representative Anderson's comment. The Board of Dentistry has rulemaking authority, so if it's needed, rulemaking is certainly a lot quicker and more efficient than, pardon me, than legislative process. It seems to me they can change their rule. If they require indirect supervision, then it seems if that rule is valid, then they can write a rule that allows general supervision when it's needed for procedures they find to be acceptable to allow dental hygienists to supervise.
And that would be on a case-by-case basis? A dentist would make application for this and they would grant it for him, but I mean...
In response to that, to keep it very simple, rulemaking, when a rule is made, it applies to everyone who is regulated by that rule.
Representative Anderson.
Chair, I think it'd be wise not to allow supervision above your own capacity, your own capability, your own training.
Well, and Representative, I would agree with that, but I don't read that. I don't read this bill as allowing that.
I think under the supervision of a dentist, Perry covers it all. The dentist can assign to the hygienist those areas where she has expertise to supervise the assistant.
The dental hygienist book of business is already defined in statute. This doesn't expand that definition in any way, so it isn't allowing a hygienist to do things. This bill does not allow them to do things that they aren't already statutorily allowed to do. So, am I correct in that?
Well, I believe that in a previous bill or under law before, that there was under a dentist or under the supervision of a dentist, and that's been taken out. Isn't that correct? And the Dental Association just wants to put that back in.
Chair Cruz, the clarification of that's why I say there are two issues. One change. It differs a bit, although it has some implications to what we're discussing. It's on line 16. I guess I should start here. The drafter of the bill, this is not the usual way an amendment to a law is drafted. It implies by putting all this language in boldface, this is entirely new. It isn't. It is in the definition of dental hygienist on line 16. Currently, it says works under the supervision of a dentist. And we would like that to stay in the statute. And one of the reasons for that is this. Not all dental hygienists are employees. Most of them are employees of a dentist. We do know of situations where the dental hygienist is employed by an HMO, and the dentists are contracting with the HMO and using the employees of the HMO. And if you take supervision out, in that case, you create an implication that no supervision is available in those cases, and it creates a problem for dentists who are trying to supervise and direct their dental hygienists working with them. So, and that also, it's just not needed. I believe my understanding of the reason that was written in there is the Attorney General who represented the board at the time said we need to clear up some cloud about the hygienists who can work without any supervision. Think of them as a profession that has been allowed by legislative changes to create their own business and work in settings without any involvement of the dentist at all. And if we need to change that, that's one of the things we're offering an amendment to, is to say put back in under the supervision of the dentist, and acknowledge that the limited access permit dental hygienist, when they're working under their permit, works without supervision. That ought to make everybody knowledgeable about what that means. I mean, we never thought there was a cloud on it. But, you know, if there is, then limit the change to those folks, and we'd be fine with that. And then going back to the dental hygienist supervising dental assistants, it's my understanding, and this, I guess, a difference of opinion may exist here with the Board of Dentistry, that the Board of Dentistry has authority to make rules to allow what this statute is trying to allow without going so far as to say we're creating a little liability issue here about can the somebody who really wants to become abusive of the statute, I'm leaving my patients who are coming out of conscious sedation in the hands of someone who's a dental assistant who has training in that area but still needs to have someone supervising who has as much training to help if there's an emergency. And that's just one situation. But other than that, I mean, we don't want to be in opposition to the bill. The Dental Association is delighted. The Board of Dentistry has taken quite a lot of time on the rest of the bill to explain it to us and to gain approval of the Oregon Dental Association, which is, you know, one of the regulated professions. So, but we need these two amendments or something close to them in order to remain supportive of the bill.
Okay, Gina, you said that this isn't the normal way to do it, but we've got the new language on page one and the deleted language on page two. I'm not quite sure I understand what's not normal.
To respond to your question, because the first time I read it, the way LC usually does this is it would take the statute, it would do it, it would delete, it would show what was being deleted by bracketing it as it does on the next page. And then it would insert in boldface the new language. Instead, what they've done here is delete whole sections and then in boldface create not only the old language but the new language or the omitted language in boldface, which makes it very difficult. I mean, I had to read this and write in what was left out or put in. So I think it makes it more difficult for people to understand what the legislative changes are that are offered in the bill. That's my only point.
Yeah. I think what Jane is saying is that, you know, customarily you'd see the deleted language and then you'd see the bolded language right after, line by line or section by section. You know, section 1, subsection 6, you'll have the deleted language and then you'll have the new language in bold in the same subsection. But here you're taking the entire section and deleting it. And then, is that what you're saying, Jane?
That is what I'm saying, yes.
Mass.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I clarify that issue? The board wanted to put them, the definitions, in alphabetical order. That's the only reason it was done that way, for ease of reading.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions at this point? I have a feeling that we don't have consensus on the committee at this point, so we'll probably be asking you folks to come up with language you can both agree on, if that's possible. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, you want to come up and have a bite of this apple?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, and we're in support of the bill, as Paul mentioned. We're in support of the bill as written. I have seen the language Jane Myers has proposed on behalf of ODA, but I don't yet have a copy, so I'm a slight bit of disadvantage on exact wording. But the concern, I think, with the supervision issue, that when we were sitting outside in front before the hearing trying to see the impact of this, the first of the amendments that Jane is proposing, which is deleting the word or dental hygienist, is that the kind of procedure that I think is actually quite common, as mentioned by Representative Anderson, where a dental hygienist works on a day that a dentist is not there, which is perfectly appropriate under general supervision, and needs to be assisted, that the board doesn't believe it has current authority to address that by rule, and that's what they're trying to do in this bill. That doesn't mean that the board, if the amendment was passed, couldn't add restrictions on training, and it also, most importantly, doesn't mean that an individual dentist operating in any individual office can prohibit it as a matter of his or her own procedure. It only permits dentists to allow that to happen. It doesn't require them. So I think that's our concern, is that the proposed amendment by ODA actually cuts away the ability of dentists to organize their practice in exactly that way that we think is happening, but the board thinks is not permitted under current statute. So we'll be happy to work with people on language, but I think we, after analyzing it, believe the current language of the bill actually does what needs to be done, provides the flexibility and protection, but we'll work with people on that issue. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions. Thank you, Paul. I'd invite the hygienists and the association and the board to bring us back something agreeable.
We will certainly try to, Mr. Chairman.
Or at least try, and then we'll rediscuss it at that point.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2240 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2191. Sandy.
Mr. Chair. Okay. Sorry. House Bill 2191 comes to you at the request of the Department of Employment, or the Employment Department. It's making some technical changes of including the Employment Department in existing statute under child care provisions. In addition to the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Ed, and including the Employment Department. The 2001 Legislative Assembly enacted House Bill 3659, which directed the Commission for Child Care to create an interim task force on financing quality child care. This bill is one of the products from that interim task force. And the parties involved in that, in the interim work, are here to speak to it.
That's a group, you think?
I think he probably could.
Yeah. Tom, Bobby, and Marion?
And all.
No, I think. Are you guys a trio here?
Which, again, Mr. Chair.
Well, it looks like you all use the same pen, so I guess you know each other.
Cost-conscious, effective managers.
Naples is right around the corner.
Good morning, and please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Olson. I'm administrator of the Child Care Division of the Oregon Employment Department. And with me today I have Bobby Weber, who is a member of the Child Care Financing Task Force, the Interim Financing Task Force, and Marion Smith, also a member. And the bill, House Bill 2191, is really sort of divided into two parts. One part addresses ORS 417, and I'm going to ask Ms. Smith and Ms. Weber to speak to that, and then I will speak to you on the parts of the bill that affect ORS 357A, which is the Child Care Division statute.
Good morning. I'm Bobby Weber, and I'm with the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership, and I chair the technical work group for the Finance Task Force. And I guess our real name was the Task Force on Financing Quality Child Care. And as already explained, that task force was created by the 2001 legislature, and then the members were appointed by the governor and the legislature, and we met for a period of about 6 months. The makeup, the people who were appointed include a broad representation, several legislators including Representative Lance Anderson, and also from the stakeholder groups, we had representatives of other parts of the child care system, including the what's relevant here today. We had the chair of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, and a member of that commission were also on the task force, along with medical doctors, foundation representatives, health care representatives, and a number of different aspects of businesses. The task, one of the four charges to the task force made by the last legislature was to develop recommendations about how quality child care should fit within the voluntary statewide early childhood system. And today, that's the part of the task force recommendations that I'm going to focus my comments on. We did make a presentation in November to the interim House Health and Human Services Committee on the broad range of recommendations that the task force brought forth. But the ones I'm focusing, because they're the ones in this legislation, they're the only ones that require legislative action, are to incorporate child care into the state's early childhood planning system. And the reason the task force felt so strongly about this was it is the child care, the childhood care and education arrangements that parents make. Those are the most common out-of-home voluntary activity that encompasses that, in which young children can be identified and are worked with. There's no other system where you have children voluntarily placed by their parents for long periods of time other than in the years 0 through 5, other than the childhood care and education system. Daycare centers, nursery schools, preschool centers, it goes by all kinds of names, family child care homes, but those arrangements that parents make. And I think the physicians probably said it the most strongly, that how can we talk about early childhood and not include the place where most parents voluntarily bring their children in these early years for extended periods of time. So what the amendments do is simply go through the comprehensive early childhood planning system that the state has created and insert child care. Either insert the word child care, or in some places at the local level, insert the child care resource and referral agencies by name in the planning process, or at the state level, the Employment Department or Commission for Child Care. Now, I don't know if I should be saying any more about the comprehensive voluntary collaborative early childhood planning system, or whether I should just assume that you all know what that is. What should I assume?
Madam Vice Chair?
Oh, I'm sitting with my teeth in my mouth. I think we should not assume that everybody knows what that is. So could you give us more information? Thank you.
I'm not the world's expert on this, but I am. Mary and I serve on our local county early childhood planning committee, so we have working knowledge of what it is, but there will be other people who can give you a better probably overall description. But the legislature created a process by which, instead of working independently, all of us who serve families with young children work collaboratively, and we call it the Voluntary Comprehensive Collaborative Early Childhood Planning System. And that means that the Department of Human Services, Department of Education, the Commission on Children and Families, that these different partners who are in their own way working with some aspects of support for children and families in their early years are mandated to work together and to sit together in processes and to develop documents that describe the broad range of family needs so that we can see who's doing what and we can prevent duplication. We have a better sense of where the gaps in services are, and it happens at the local county level, and then it aggregates up at the state level into comprehensive planning. And what the task force is addressing is that just inadvertently child care got left out, probably because child care is almost entirely a marketplace, private enterprise. The providers of childhood care and education services in this state, as in other states, are predominantly small businesses, for-profit or not-for-profit businesses. They're not operated by the state. That's probably why they're not as easy to bring into the planning mix. But we have the Employment Department Child Care Division that works with all of these providers, and we have the Commission for Child Care. So what the task force did was simply went through and looked for appropriate places in the early childhood planning statute and said, if we just insert child care here, then that will improve the planning system by making it broader and strengthening it by having this system that serves so many of the children for so many years, for long periods of time involved in the planning.
Great. Just for the record, I think that everyone up here understands the basic infrastructure, and that Vice Chair Tomei was illuminated by your presentation.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Ms. Weber?
Yes. It doesn't define local child care resource and referral agencies. So when this, and by the way, I am a strong advocate of adding child care. This is my. I actually have a bill submitted, don't have the draft back yet, that enhances this child care piece, because if we add it, that means really there needs to be more funding, and there are hopefully some federal funds. But I've talked to Tom about this, but that hopefully will come to us later. But we haven't really defined a resource and referral agency. What do you mean by that?
Representative Monis Anderson, they're defined in statute. They were created in a statewide system of local child care resource and referral agencies was created by the legislature in 1989.
But
and
what is that?
Oh, what are they? They are sometimes they're called the hub of the wheel. They're local nonprofit agencies, usually housed in a larger agency or organization, community colleges, community action agencies. They exist to make local child care work. They include a database of all the child care providers they can find in that community. They help parents understand what good child care looks like. They help them find child care. They help them find child care subsidies if they're eligible for them. They help the DHS families figure out how to make child care work as they transition from welfare to work. They work with local employers to help them meet the child care needs of their employees. And they do a lot of work with the child care providers themselves. They mentor them. They consult with them. They help them find any kind of training that's available in the community. They actually provide some training. So we think of them as the hub of the wheel, the link nonprofits that hold the system together, and then they have a state association, the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, that makes them available at the state level. But mainly they're local, and there are 16 of them. They serve the entire state.
And follow up?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that we knew that it wasn't really the child care providers that we're talking
about. That's right. No, it's not.
Just referral, resource and referral agencies.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
I'm Marion Smith, and also a member of the task force. I wanted to be here to see if you had any questions specifically about any of the legislative parts, because I'm the one who actually, during the task force, went back to the old legislation and looked at what we had to change to make the amendments in our report. So that's my function here today. So if you have any questions, Mr. Chair, of me, specifically about each of the parts of the legislation.
Any questions of Ms. Smith? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. Second part.
Identify.
Sorry, I am. I'm Tom Olson, the administrator of the Child Care Division of the Oregon Employment Department.
Thank you, Tom.
I'll be testifying on the portions of House Bill 2191 that affect the Child Care Division statute, which is ORS 657A, and the legislation that would be sections 7 and forward. The first thing in Section 7, Ms. Weber just described to you briefly the function of child care resource and referral agencies. They are the hub of the child care system in the state of Oregon, and if they were not there, the state would require probably 150, 200 more FTE to do the work that these workers out in the local communities are currently doing. Back when the legislation was established in 1989, there was language that provided that the local agencies would provide a matching amount equal to the grant funds received from the state for child care services. The way that's been interpreted through the years is basically to be a 50% match requirement, and which is extremely high, and it's gotten to the point where it's really unworkable for the local agencies. Last session, the legislature approved a policy option package that allowed us to provide increased federal funding, significantly increased federal funding to the local child care resource and referral agencies. The upshot of that, combined with the fact that child care resource and referral is now statewide, and there really is now no general fund in it at all, is that the local agencies are under obligation to try to match all the federal funds they're getting at a ratio of 50%. That's currently the highest rate of any state in the nation. The highest rate that I can find outside of Oregon is 10%. And so what we're proposing is an amendment to the statute that would require the child care resource and referrals to match the federal funds they receive from the state at 10%. And it's gotten the economic conditions out in the communities these days. Local governments are having very difficult times making ends meet, and it's getting difficult for them to meet that match requirement, and the resource and referrals have difficulty finding it. And so our recommendation, and the recommendation in this bill, is that the match rate be reduced to 10%, more consistent with the other states in the nation, and certainly more affordable for Oregon's communities.
So just a question?
Yes.
So, Tom, what you're saying is that right now we're matching dollar for dollar, and now we will only be matching 1 to 9.
Right. That's correct.
And we'll still get the same amount of money.
Yes. It won't affect the federal money.
More from the feds?
Yes. The amount of federal money hopefully will remain the same, assuming that they don't reduce the money that we receive for child care resource and referral through the block grant. But yes, it will require the agencies to match 10% of that total. And right now, they spend an inordinate amount of time trying to document places that might be considered match, and it's sort of an exercise in bureaucracy that isn't necessary because it's in a lot of cases they're really scrambling to try to do this, and it's takes really time away from what they're doing.
Hola?
Yes.
So how much did we of our general fund went last biennium to, do you know how much went into our match for the child care dollars, block grant dollars?
Our match rate is approximately $20 million a year. Right.
Okay. So now this time we would only need to 20, that'd be 40. So come out to. So it's 10% of that then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. It's the match that we're required to provide to the federal government is sort of outside of this. This is a requirement in statute. There's no requirement in federal statute that these folks match the money. The state of Oregon as a whole is required to come up with a matching amount, and we do that through a number of ways. We use the amount that we provide to pre-kindergarten programs in state general fund. We use the amount of general fund that supports the employment-related daycare program at DHS. We use a portion of Oregon's tax credits. So basically we're fine. We're meeting all the federal requirements without the resource and referral match. That really was never ever counted towards the federal dollar match. The only reason they were doing this is to meet the intent of the Oregon statute.
Any other questions of Tom before he proceeds? Thank you, Tom.
Moving to Section 8, we're proposing an amendment to Section 250, Sub 3, that expands the definition of child care child to children up to the age of 18, or I'm sorry, children under the age of 18 if they have special needs that require care over and above the norm for a child of that age. And the reason for that is that we are able to, with under federal regulations, to serve children with special needs up to the age of 18, but currently that's not specifically mentioned in the statute. So this is basically a technical adjustment that will allow us to continue to serve children with special needs if they have special needs over and above the norm for kids of that age. Sub 5 includes a child care component of teen parent programs operated by public schools. And I do want to propose a technical amendment here because it should read teen parent programs and child development programs operated by public schools to be subject to regulation by the child care division. There aren't many of them out there that are not regulated. There are maybe a half a dozen to a dozen, according to the woman who oversees the program at the state level. But she felt, and we feel, and the Finance Task Force felt, that it was very essential to send a message to schools that operate child development programs that there is such a thing as regulation, that it is important, and that child care centers and child care operations should be licensed by the state. And, again, this would not be a workload issue for us because there are only about a half a dozen of them out there that are not currently being certified by the child care division. But this would just send the message that all child development programs where children where high school students are working in them should be subject to regulation.
Tom, you were proposing this amendment, or did you have this amendment?
Madam Chair, we are proposing the amendment right now. We will have a dash one amendment available for the committee.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Any questions of Tom? You have something more, Tom?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I sure wish there were more certified daycare providers. Isn't that what you're talking about here?
It is.
And hopefully down the road we can have incentives to facilities so that they do actually become certified. Because one of the most difficult things I think a parent has if they have to work, and many of us did have to work and do work with small children, that we really don't know what's out there that's good. I mean, this is wonderful legislation to at least now have the referral agencies listed in the comprehensive plan, but then to figure out what the quality of these places are, and if we can somehow get more licensed child care providers, then that definitely sends a message, hey, they have reached some rigorous standards. So that was just a comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Section 5, sub G, I'm sorry, sub 5, sub G, is adding child care programs that are operated as parent cooperatives for no more than 4 hours a day as programs that we're proposing to exempt from regulation. And the reason that we're doing that is because these are programs that are, in fact, are operated by the parents of the children, and they operate for short periods of time. We're working with Representative Dingfelder's office on this also, and her office has proposed another technical adjustment, which will be that there be an emergency clause added to this legislation so that it is effective on passage. And we're also defining what constitutes a parent cooperative, and that is that the care is provided by parents on a rotating basis, that the membership in the cooperative includes parents, that there are written policies and procedures, and that a board of directors controls the policies. So these are for specifically for programs where parents are in fact providing the child care.
Follow up on that?
Yes.
Now, co-ops was taken out of statute at one point in time, and now it's being added back because there was abuse of certain child care providers would say they were a co-op and they really weren't. So how does this prevent the abuse that occurred when they were in statute?
Madam Chair, Representative Montes Anderson, it's by defining what constitutes a co-op.
And
it does, in fact, add language that defines what constitutes a co-op. Again, it's care provided by the parents, and the membership includes parents. There are written policies and procedures, and the board of directors controls the policies and procedures of the program. So it's tightened up to the point where we feel comfortable with it.
Okay, Tom, you want to proceed?
Sub 5H is adding child care programs that provide care while parents are on site as programs that we propose to exempt from regulation. And again, this would primarily be health clubs. Some health clubs have child care programs where parents drop off the children for a playtime while they work out. They're very short periods of time that the children are left in these programs, and the parents are on site. And again, the controlling aspect here is the fact that the parents are on site and are reachable by the children.
Tom, I have a question for you. On the parent cooperative, who are members of the board of the directors? Are they parents?
Madam Chair, yes. In most cases, they are, in fact, parents. And the membership of the co-op has to include parents.
But not totally. The board of directors can include people other than parents.
It can, Madam Chair, yes. Under the current language, it can include persons other than parents.
Would the majority of the people on the board be parents?
Madam Chair, of the ones that I'm aware of, yes, they just about all are. But the language does not specifically state that the members of the board have to be parents or that a certain percentage has to be parents.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Is there another question?
Go ahead.
The remainder of the bill, sections 9 through 12, is primarily all technical corrections, and they're made to reflect terminology changes that occurred when we revised the rules for what used to be called group homes. They're now called certified family homes, and it's cleanup language that basically goes through and corrects wherever you see a group home, you'll now see certified family home. And the division does not anticipate any fiscal impact by any portion of this bill. And that concludes my testimony.
Great.
And I'll take questions.
Any questions of Tom? All right, thank you. Donna Middleton. You know the drill.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. Here to speak on House Bill 2191,
First of all, to let you know that the State Commission on Children and Families has not taken a position on this legislation. However, I would like to provide some information to the committee on two pieces of the legislation. The first piece of the legislation is on Section 2, where it adds the Employment Department to the partnership with the State Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Education, and the Department of Human Services. I'd like to state that in this particular piece of legislation, that the Employment Department, along with the Child Care Commission staff, have been members of an early childhood team since House Bill 3159 was, or 3659 was implemented. So sometimes when legislation comes up and something is inserted, sometimes it's the belief that it isn't, that there hasn't been this partnership going on. And so I just want to let you know that the Department of Employment, as well as the Child Care Commission, have been full partners in working through the early childhood team to develop an early childhood system of supports in all 36 communities, as well as information and referral. Information referral was one of the required partners for our community comprehensive planning in all 36 counties for the 0 to 8 piece of the comprehensive plan.
Excuse me, but when you're talking about information referral, you're talking about child care.
Child care information referral. Excuse me, yes, that's correct. And so I wanted to let you know that this is already happening. So the legislation just supports basically what we're already doing in communities in most parts. And so wanted to just let you know that those folks are already at the table and planning with us, both at the state and local level. The other part is the part around Section 3, which is adds the Director of Employment Department, or at the Governor's direction, the Chairperson of the Commission for Child Care. The State Commission on Children and Families has a number of individuals from a number of different perspectives sitting on the State Commission. One of those members currently is Joanne Mixis. She's a retired educator and has a specialty in early childhood. So once again, we are trying to look at a broad perspective on the State Commission, and you know, would have no position on this particular placement. However, would like you to know that we hope that all systems are fully represented at the State Commission level.
Thank you.
I'll take any questions.
Any questions of Donna Middleton? Thank you very much. Jim Austin from Representative Dingfelter's office. Jim, are you coming to testify, or are we going to wait for Representative Dingfelter?
I'm sitting in for
her. Great. Come on up.
Can I go with Larissa Allen?
Of course. And Larissa? And please identify yourself
For the record, my name is Jim Austin. I'm legislative assistant for Representative Jackie Dingfelter, who regrettably could not be here today. But we're here to articulate our support for the measure, in particular the sections dealing with parent cooperatives. We worked with the Child Care Commission and the Employment Department this summer to include that back in. And with regards to the specifics, and you all had some of you had some questions about parent cooperatives, so I've asked Losha Iacker from Parent Child Care Preschools of Oregon to tell you a little bit more about parent cooperatives and the role they serve.
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Larissa Iacker, and I'm here representing Parent Child Preschools of Oregon, which is a membership organization of about 60 co-op preschools throughout the state, and about 2,200 families at those schools. One thing I wanted to clarify was you were asking about the board of directors. I would say in 90% of the cases, the board of directors is completely made up of the parents of the children. In some cases, there might be another person, an alumni, that has decided to stay on, or most of the co-ops are located in churches. They rent space from churches, and sometimes a representative of the church might be on the board as well. But those are small cases, and we would be willing to work together to maybe closer define that definition of the board of directors if necessary. And I also just wanted to explain our support for the bill in that co-ops really serve a very unique need in the community, in that it's a lower cost alternative. A lot of these parents don't quite qualify for Head Start, but they can't afford other child care or preschool arrangements. And in a co-op, they're able to be involved in the classroom, also in committee jobs, board positions. They're involved in school policies and decision-making. And in most cases, co-ops have an excellent child-to-adult ratio. It's usually 4-to-1 or 5-to-1, whereas the state requirements are 10-to-1. Co-ops also provide opportunities for parent education, quite often free or at very low cost. They hold meetings during the year for the purpose of parenting education, where they bring in speakers and schedule workshops. Are there any questions, specifically about co-ops and what they are? And
questions, Larissa or Jim? Seeing none.
Actually, if I...
Please.
Mr. Olson, the Employment Department mentioned the friendly amendment, the implementation. I don't know if you have any questions about that, but it would be helpful to, for instance, the organization, if this could be implemented upon passage, because they're starting to do recruitment right now, and they typically start recruiting and do enrollment in September.
Right. Most of our co-ops follow the public school schedule, so they start in September. But most of them are doing their enrollment and open houses and recruiting right now for the fall, and they need some sort of clarification on where they stand here.
Mr. Chair, I need to defer to you. Are you listening to this? Hmm? Have you been listening to mm-hmm. their questions? So I need to defer to you. What do we need to do to respond to their concerns?
So you want an emergency clause?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I believe that Mr. Olson of the Employment Department was going to do
-1
amendment.
I'm assuming that's part of the amendments you're going to be offering.
Yes, we can.
We just wait for the amendments.
Okay, great. That's appropriate for you?
Yes.
Great. Any other questions?
Let me ask a question. I assume the co-ops are different than the healthcare centers. Is that true? You're talking about parent co-ops, right?
Correct.
And you were.
Oh, I'm also talking about parent co-ops.
Yeah. Okay. And tell me the relationship they have to the CCRNRs. The CCRNRs are referral agencies into referring parents to co-ops. I was a little confused.
Okay,
that.
If I may. What the section of the bill the measure that we're referring to is a re-inclusion, if you will, of an exemption to certification for child care facilities. It had been an exemption. Parent co-ops had been listed as an exemption earlier. It had been taken out because there was no statutory definition for parent cooperatives, and there had been some question about standards.
Tom.
Very good. Thank you.
Something to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Anderson, to your question, child care resource and referrals, in fact, do make referrals of parents, refer parents to child care. They may, in fact, if they have a they keep extensive databases of all the child care facilities in their area. And if, in fact, there is a parent cooperative, and if, in fact, if the cooperative wants to accept new members, they could, in fact, refer someone to a parent cooperative, but they would have to understand that in order to do that, they would have to be a part of the cooperative. In other words, parent cooperatives only work when the parents provide the care. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
They do work together quite often in that the resource and referral agencies refer families to our organization for co-ops, and we do the same. If someone calls us and then finds out exactly what a co-op is and they're not able to work that sort of schedule, then we refer them to the resource and referral agency. So.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Can I close this public hearing? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2191. And seeing no further business, I close this meeting.
We are adjourned.
We are adjourned. Thank you.